Today's episode of This Week I Learned is brought to you by the Lincoln MKZ Hybrid, with a fully retractable panoramic roof for more sky than any other luxury sedan. Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week, I learned that dogs can smell happiness. There's a common belief among dog owners and the decidedly less canine enthusiastic that dogs can smell fear. But a team of researchers wanted to get to the bottom of this assumption and answer the question, can dogs really smell our emotions? A team of scientists from the University of Naples put some pup sniffers to the test. First, they had to gather the scent. Researchers had human volunteers watch videos that would elicit a fearful response, a happy response, or a neutral response. Then the team collected samples of their sweat. The odor samples were then presented to, let's be honest, probably some adorable Labradors and Golden Retrievers. And what they found was that the dogs exposed to fear smells showed more signs of stress than those exposed to happy or neutral smells. These dogs also had higher heart rates, sought out the comfort of their owners, and made less social contact with strangers. But on the plus side, the dogs who sniffed the sweat of happy humans were more likely to approach strangers. They also did not seek out their owners as much, and their heart rates were significantly lower. What the study shows is that dogs can not only smell happiness and fear, but that they'll actually match those emotions based on scent alone. So your emotions can hijack your dogs. This week I learned that bees can be right or left-handed too. Well, handed isn't quite the word, but bees appear to have a left or right bias that influences their decisions navigating obstacles while mid-flight. To figure this out, researchers out of the University of Queensland in Australia spent a lot of time watching bees. First, they dabbed 102 foraging bees with different colors so that each was distinct. Then they built a 47-inch long tunnel with a feeder at the end. In the middle of the tunnel was an obstacle with two holes that were adjustable. Then researchers sent the bees through, and what they found was that when the two holes were the same size, around 45% of the bees showed a preference for the right or the left hole. That preference was actually split down the middle, with half going to the right and half to the left. The other 55% showed no preference for one hole over the other. But things really got interesting when the biased bees were forced to choose between the smaller hole on the side they preferred or a bigger hole on the side they avoided. If the bees' preferred side was smaller, it took them longer to decide which hole to go through. What's cool is how researchers connected this handedness with a swarm's flight strategy. Evolutionarily speaking, it wouldn't make much sense for the swarm as a whole if all the bees possessed the same bias, since that would mean all the bees would try to pass with the same, say, left passage when the right was perfectly fine too. This would hold up the swarm and possibly endanger the lives of many. It also wouldn't be helpful if all the bees had no bias, since all the bees would then likely fly through the optimally sized hole, once again overcrowding the passage and slowing down the process. So the fact that about half of the bees are biased toward one size or another ensures that our busy bees are as efficient as possible. This week, I learned that the heart of 19th century Polish composer Frédéric Chopin sits pickled in a jar encased in a stone pillar in a Warsaw church. Frédéric François Chopin was born in Poland in 1810 to a Polish mother and a French father. Frederick began studying piano very early, performing his first concert when he was just 8 years old and quickly besting his teachers. By the age of 20, his talents earned some attention outside of Poland. Early compositions for piano and orchestra had some people calling the young man a genius. He became known as the poet of the piano because his talents in this realm were unmatched. In the end, Chopin had only 30 years of concerting and gave only 30 live performances. He died in Paris in 1849 at the age of 39. Now, here's where it gets strange. Chopin had a fear of being buried alive. So, on his deathbed, he asked that his heart be cut before burial and sent back to his beloved homeland. So, the rest of his body was buried in Paris. It was Chopin's older sister, Ludwika, who followed through with the composer's gruesome request. The heart was put into a jar of booze, likely cognac, which was used for tissue preservation back in the day. Ludwika slipped the jar under her skirts, avoided border guards and agents, and smuggled the heart back to Warsaw, Poland, where it was buried beneath a small monument at the Holy Cross Church. The heart became a symbol of national pride for Poles, so much so that during World War II, the Nazis stole the heart and banned Chopin's music to dampen Poland's nationalist spirit. The Nazis then went on to slaughter hundreds and thousands of Poles in retribution for the Warsaw Uprising of 1944, but strangely, they took great pains to preserve the heart of the composer that they had stolen. Germans, you see, had a soft spot for Chopin and sometimes claimed him as their own because of the influence some of the great German composers, namely Bach and Mozart, had on the young man. Luckily, after the war, the heart was returned and reinterred in the church, and this is where it has remained basically undisturbed ever since. That was until 2014, when a clandestine group of scientists, clergy, and medical experts dug up the heart to make sure the tissue had remained well preserved. Knowing the emotional connection Poland had to this pickled organ, the researchers exhumed the heart in the middle of the night. Experts had long wanted to carry out genetic testing on it, but were only granted a superficial inspection. But still, the analysis was telling. Noticing that it was massively enlarged and had a frosted substance on it, researchers were able to conclude that Chopin had suffered from pericarditis, an inflammation of tissue around the heart that was likely the result of tuberculosis. The group took more than 1,000 photos of the organ, added hot wax to the jar's seal to prevent evaporation, and returned the heart to its resting place, where it remains today. This week I learned that not all that long ago, you could pay someone to eat your sins. Sin eating was a part of a Christian funeral ritual in medieval times and up through the 18th and 19th centuries in the United Kingdom and some parts of North America. Sin eaters were usually used by families who had lost a loved one quite suddenly before they could confess their sins and be sent to heaven. It was not a respectable job. Sin eating was usually taken on by the poor and destitute because it meant being ostracized from the village and, of course, bearing the burden of housing the sins of the damned and the dead. And it didn't even pay that much, the equivalent of just a few dollars today. The family of the deceased would hire a sin eater and invite him or her into their home during or after the funeral. He would sit down at a table and was likely facing the door. Set before him was typically a piece of bread and a cup of beer or wine. He'd receive his meager coin payment and consume the plain meal before him. Before leaving, he would, according to at least one account from 1813, turn to the group and say, "The ease and rest of the soul departed." And off he'd go with the deceased sins. The families of the deceased believed the bread was the vessel of the sins, and once consumed, all of the misdeeds were passed on to this hired help. For those who believed in the powers of this unenviable job, the sin eaters were performing a necessary role that sacrificed their own soul. With each job and each piece of bread consumed, the sin eater became more evil. The church, for its part, did not abide by this ritual, and the custom eventually died out in the 19th century, though there are tales of sin eating persisting through the 1950s, but those aren't verified. It's readily believed that the last sin eater was an Englishman by the name of Richard Munslow, who died in 1906. But Munslow was against type. He was a well-established farmer in a small village in England. And despite the history of sin eaters being ostracized from the church, Munslow was actually buried in his village graveyard. According to some records, Munslow became a sin eater after the sudden sequent deaths of his three children, who died of whooping cough. He was able to continue his work as a farmer as he consumed the sins of the dead. In 2010, locals raised money to restore Munslow's grave, which had fallen into disrepair. The village and the church thought it worthwhile to highlight this custom and Munslow's unique place in religious history. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can check out theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. And if you've come across any scientific tidbits, fascinating studies, or historical revelations that you'd like to share, email me. You can reach me at podcasts@theweek.com. Until next week, I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.